Oh, send out your light and your truth. Let them lead us. Let them lead us to your holy hill and to your dwelling. Then we will go to your altar, O God, our exceeding joy. And we will praise you with the harp, O God, our God. Amen. It's wonderful to see everyone this morning. I don't think I've been here in this pulpit since just about this time last year, so it's great to be back. I'm so grateful to the ministers and to the musicians and to the readers for creating such a beautiful and thoughtful, rich context for our worship. Thank you all so much. It's great to see some students from our summer school here. We have just a few more weeks to go, but you have blessed our campus with your presence, and we're so glad to be with you. I'm so glad to be with you here, as well as running into you in Seaver Hall. My text for this sermon is from the 6th chapter of John. When they were satisfied, Jesus told his disciples, "Gather up the fragments so that nothing may be lost." 2 years ago, the South African artist William Kentridge created a 500-meter frieze on the wall that runs along the Tiber River in Rome. Called Triumphs and Laments, Kentridge's mural depicts moments from Roman history that range from Rome's founding myths to the very recent stories of the refugees who risked everything to get there. The images are not in chronological order, but rather appear in unexpected combinations that illuminate the ways in which triumphs always bear laments in their wake. Kentridge created his frieze using a method called reverse graffiti. He placed enormous stencils of the images against the wall and pressure washed around them so that the images that remained were made from the dirt and pollution and the organic matter that has accumulated on the wall over the years. It's almost as if the images had been hidden there all along, lost in the patina of grime. The images, 80 of them, process along the river wall for over a third of a mile. Some of them are iconic and familiar, like Romulus and Remus being nursed by the wolf. Some of them are playful. At one point along the way, a nun is depicted as receiving communion from a mocha, the ubiquitous Italian coffee pot. Other images are devastating. The torment of Jews by Christians during Mardi Gras in Piazza Navona. Refugees mourning those they lost on their perilous journey across the Mediterranean Sea. And throughout the mural, there are images that starkly illustrate Kentridge's theme of the intertwining of triumph and lament. Remus lying dead, killed by his brother on the day Rome was founded. Roman soldiers returning to the city after the sack of Jerusalem, holding aloft the treasures of the temple they had sacked. One of the most compelling images in this mural, though, is neither iconic nor familiar. It's a simple dark panel that appears to be on wheels, a sort of caravan, part of the moving procession. Scrawled across it is the phrase, "Quello che non ricordo," what I do not remember. In the midst of a procession of some of the most well-known stories in human history is an image marking what has been forgotten, the stories that have been lost. I was lucky enough to see Kentridge's mural when he first put it up on the Tiber wall, and I was drawn again and again to this image, the artist's attempt to represent not only what he knows, but what he does not. And what he does not know, and what we do not know, is most of history. The stories of people, events, relationships, and gestures that moved history forward, but are now forgotten. The hidden history that was never written down in a book or captured with an image on a wall. Quello che non ricordo, what I do not remember. I began to think of Kentridge's dark caravan of forgotten stories as a kind of ark carrying God's memory. The mural acknowledges that what we know of history, even of our own history, is always fractured and incomplete. But it also suggests that just because most of history is lost to us, that doesn't mean it's wholly lost, doesn't mean that it isn't held in the fathomless depths of God's memory. The stories about Jesus in the Gospels and the stories Jesus tells evoke a God who refuses to allow things to remain lost. In the Gospel of Luke, when Jesus is criticized for eating with sinners, he responds with a trilogy of parables about how far God will go to seek out and retain animals, objects, and people that others might believe to be disposable. The first parable is about a shepherd who cannot tolerate the loss of even one sheep from the flock of 100. The image of that shepherd with his one lost sheep slung around his shoulders appears in the Roman catacombs, and no wonder. Having buried their lost loved ones and seen the resting place that awaited them below ground, early Christians must have been comforted to encounter in that dark warren of graves the image of a shepherd who would never leave a sheep behind, never give up until the last one had been recovered. The story of the lost sheep is followed by another story of a determined seeker of what has been lost, the woman who has lost a coin. She lights her lamp and sweeps her home and searches every corner, Jesus says, until she finds it. She will tolerate nothing going to waste, not even a penny. The third story is about a father whose youngest son loses his way in search of a good time and then struggles to find a way back home. Believing he can't return as a son but might have a chance as a servant, the young man turns his face to his father's house and is surprised to find that his father has never stopped scanning the horizon for him. These parables imagine God in many different forms, as a shepherd, as a woman, as a father. But all of these manifestations of God have something in common. They all go to great lengths to recover what has been lost, and they all rejoice when they do. In our story from John's Gospel this morning, Jesus remains concerned with even the smallest losses. Gather up the fragments so that nothing may be lost, Jesus says to his disciples, after the crowd of 5,000 feasts on a few loaves and fishes, leaving leftovers scattered on the ground. The God Jesus makes present to the world is a God who is forever seeking and finding, gathering and remembering, a God who cannot bear to lose one sheep, one coin, one child, or one broken piece of fish or bread. A few verses later in the same chapter, Jesus reminds us again of God's conviction that nothing and no one is disposable. This is the will of the one who sent me, Jesus says, that I should lose nothing of all that God has given me, but raise it up on the last day. The story about Jesus feeding 5,000 people with only a few loaves of bread and a few fish is the only miracle story that is told in all four Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all knew it, even when they're using different sources. It must have been a story that the earliest Christians loved to tell, one they remembered and passed on, one that was important to their understanding of who Jesus was. The story echoes another one from the second book of Kings, which we also heard read this morning, about a man who brought an offering to the prophet Elisha of 20 loaves of barley and some grain, ears of grain during a time of famine. Elisha instructs the man to give his offering to the people so that they can eat. And the man, like the disciples in our gospel story, protests that he only has a little. He doesn't have enough, he says, to feed a crowd of hungry people. Give them the food, Elisha says, so they can eat. And the man does, and the people eat their fill, and somehow there's food left over. Both of these stories seem at first to be about scarcity, about not having enough to meet the need the world presents. But they turn out to be stories of abundance. While those around them worry and fret that their resources will never stretch far enough, both Elisha and Jesus remain calm and unruffled. This is not a zero-sum game for them, in which meeting some people's needs means that there won't be enough for the needs of others. Jesus and Elisha have an expectation of abundance, an expectation that if we share, there will be enough for all. God's economy of abundance is a hard sell these days. We are being told another story. It's a story of scarcity, a zero-sum story, the gospel of America first. If we let all the asylum seekers in, the story goes, there won't be enough jobs for everyone. If we welcome families who are running for their lives, there will not be enough for our families. If we let too many refugees in, our country will change and we will lose our culture. We are being told a story of scarcity in which sharing means losing what we have. That story is a lie, because it suggests that our resources are finite and unchanging, because it ignores the way resources multiply when a community works together to welcome the stranger and feed the hungry, when courageous and resourceful people are given a chance to build a new life and generate new ideas and new possibilities. Give these hungry people some food, Elisha and Jesus say. And not only were the crowds of hungry people fed, but there was food left over. More food, more life, more possibility. Are these really miracle stories? If so, they describe an ordinary miracle that is well within our reach. The story from John's Gospel of Jesus feeding the 5,000 is not only a story about God's economy of abundance, but also a story about being good stewards of that abundance. Gather up the fragments, Jesus says, so that nothing may be lost. Like the good shepherd who goes out after the one lost sheep, like the woman who turns her house upside down to find one lost coin, like the father who never stops waiting and watching for his lost son to return and rejoices when he does, Jesus teaches his disciples and us that nothing and no one is disposable. It is the will of the one who sent me, Jesus says, that I should lose nothing of all that God has given me, but raise it up on the last day. In God's economy, everything is worth savoring, even scraps of bread and fish. And everyone is worth saving in every sense of that word. Everyone is worthy of being known and cared for and raised up. I imagine that Jesus instructed his disciples to gather up the fragments of the meal they had shared with the hungry crowd, because he knew that it's easy to think of fragments and broken pieces as disposable. When our government breaks up families at the border, they seem to be trying to make them more easily disposable. When families have been shattered, it's easier to warehouse children in places where they are vulnerable to abuse and violence, easier to lose track of which foster homes and institutions we've sent them to, easier to deport parents back to the countries they had fled before they have their children safe in their arms again. If we were to make a mural of our country's history, like William Kentridge did for Rome, it would have to include the images that we see in the news each day, images of frantic parents and traumatized children. The harm of separation is accomplished in a moment, the healing of that harm an impossibly long time. The stories we heard this morning from the Bible, of welcoming and nourishing, of remembering and gathering, are not just the relics of our ancestors in faith, not just the easily demythologized miracle stories. They are living and active commentaries on the world we're living in. They resist the story of America first, the story of scarcity that stirs up fear and leads to the violence that is happening now in our midst and in our name. These are stories to navigate by, their vision of abundance and wholeness, a light to illuminate our path and guide us around the dangerous stories that we are being told. These are stories to remember, stories to tell and retell, stories to pass on. Almost 90 years ago, the Harvard philosopher Alfred North Whitehead described the nature of God using the language of our gospel reading this morning. God's nature is best conceived, Whitehead wrote in Process and Reality, as a tender care that nothing be lost. This nature, Whitehead went on to say, is God's judgment on the world. I feel that judgment in the distance between the God whose nature it is to seek out the lost, remember the forgotten, and restore the broken, and my own carelessness and inaction, my own fragmented awareness of the harm I have done and the harm that is being done in my name. So what can we do in these days? We can support and amplify the efforts of organizations that are doing the painstaking work of finding and reuniting separated parents and children, raising bond money, providing transportation, doing the legwork that children and parents in detention cannot do. We can join with those who are refusing to forget, refusing to be satisfied with the government's claim that all eligible families have been reunited. We can join them in keeping the pressure on. We all need to find ways of responding to this catastrophe, but we also need to cultivate practices that bring us into alignment with the vision of the stories we have heard this morning, so that we are ready to respond to whatever comes next and to imagine a different future. We need opportunities to learn and practice God's economy of abundance, where sharing leads not to loss, but to fresh possibilities for growth and change. We need communities like this one, where we can tell and retell the stories of God's seeking and finding, God's gathering and remembering, where we can feel the claim on us of that tender care that nothing be lost. We need practices of teaching and learning, art making, and scholarship that remember and honor both what we know and what we do not, building an ark for God's memory in which nothing and no one is lost, and every forgotten thing is shining. Amen.